Hi there. Welcome to the Agency Toolkit Podcast, a podcast where we discuss stories, strategies, and techniques to help you build a successful and profitable digital marketing agency. Our episodes contain inspiring conversations with CEOs and entrepreneurs and leave you with actionable tips, ideas, and strategies you can implement into your business today. We are happy to have you with us. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and get inspired.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Agency Toolkit. I'm your host, Julia McLaughlin. This episode is sponsored by ReviewRobin, a review management software for marketing agencies to help you guys get your clients more positive reviews. You can check that out at getreviewrobin.com. Now, my guest today is Shahar Arez, who is the co-founder and CEO of Stoke, an on-demand talent platform empowering companies to adopt a hybrid workforce model that scales as quickly and efficiently as needed. The platform provides a streamlined interface to make sure all your non-employees are operating according to policies, legal constraints, and workforce classification. In 2021, Stoke was acquired by Fiverr for $110 million just 15 months after coming out of stealth mode. So today we're going to be discussing both the benefits and risks of working with freelancers and also touch on Shahar's experience in getting acquired by Fiverr. Thanks so much for joining us today, Shahar.
Thanks for having me, Julia. It's great being here.
Perfect. So to get started, let's dive into a couple questions so our listeners can get to know you a little bit. So tell us to start, where are you tuning in from today?
I'm currently in Tel Aviv. I'm looking outside my window. I was born and raised in Israel. I lived in California for a few years, moved back almost 10 years ago. And for the past decade, give or take, I've been splitting my time between California and Tel Aviv. And you know, when COVID hit, I'm kind of doing everything through Zoom, so I'm not traveling anymore.
Okay, awesome. And then, so what would you say really motivates or inspires you as an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. You know, for many years, most of my career, I was more of an entrepreneur, working within corporates and building new businesses within corporates. And I think where it led me towards is not to take something that exists and just try to make it a bit better. There's a lot of companies are taking something that exists and, you know, apply newer technology or do something else. From my career, three or four times, I just looked at where I think the market's going, taking bigger risks and kind of building things where I think the puck is going to be, you know, 3, 5, 10 years down the road. You know, in hindsight, it's easy to say I was right in all four times. Again, not all of them I was able to drive the success myself, but kind of understanding where the market's going to be. You're not always accurate if it's going to take 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, but you kind of understand how things are going to be. So as an entrepreneur, what inspires me is really creating new business categories, driving significant change to how business gets conducted, and making an impact on organizations and individuals' performance and efficiency.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it's so true. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, it's risky being an entrepreneur, but they do play it safe by just sort of expanding on existing markets. So it's really inspiring to hear that you just really have that, you're that big picture thinker, and you're just working to create a category of your own.
I don't know if it's it comes out of, you know, such a bold ambition. I just think that I have a lot of doubts when I kind of say, well, like, take something to exist and just make it a bit better. I was like, is anybody going to actually want to buy it? Is it so much better that it's worth it?
Yeah.
I think I'm much better in drawing out a long-term vision than a short-term improvement.
Very good. So tell us more about Stoke Talent and why you decided to create a talent platform.
Well, I've decided to create I didn't think about it as a talent platform in the beginning, but throughout my career, I've been in the industry for over two decades now, over 20 years. And I led organizations from, you know, small teams to large, you know, 50, 100 people organizations. Mm-hmm. And what you get to see when you're dealing with such large organizations, the ability to drive impact in the organization, obviously there's correlation between the number of people and the impact, but the bigger the organization gets, there's this correlation You know, if you get from 90 people to 100 people, you don't get 10% more productivity. What you get is, you know, 2, 3, 4% more, because you lose capacity that way. Mm-hmm. And so I was always trying to create organizations that are efficient, that everyone's really working on what they should be working in. But it's really difficult within how organizations work. In 2012, I founded my previous startup, and we tried to raise funds. We couldn't raise funds. So we decided to bootstrap, and mm-hmm. we started working with freelancers because we didn't have money for full-time employees. And so we started using online marketplaces. It was early days for them. So we used Odesk and, you know, early days of Fiverr. And it was difficult. Me and my co-founder, we worked at the same, we have pretty much the same track record at the same companies. And so we knew how to work with full-time employees, how to build, you know, large-scale teams and all of that. But when we started working freelance, like, how do we work with these people? So do we interview them? Do we interview someone for a $50 job as an example? So we kind of got into, it took us 3 months to kind of figure out what's the right cadence, how much should we invest in, figuring out whether we should work with this person or not. Mm-hmm. But after 3 months, we got our stride. And we're just amazed by the level of efficiency we're able to get with working with freelancers. We had 18 people working for us in that mall. Some of them working for, you know, short-term gigs, two, three-day projects, just, you know, turning something around. Some of them worked with us for 6 to 9 months mm-hmm. in New York, New Rochester, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, all over the world. We didn't care where they are. Yeah. But what is it they're bringing with programmers, designers, content writers, it's, you know, just a plethora of whatever it is we needed, whatever we could, we needed. And again, from someone coming from within corporate and being used to the fact that if you need to get something done, you have to go through the pipes, open headcount, job description, go to HR, publish the job, get interviews. You know, from the moment you make a decision, you need something until you get, you know, excuse my French, butt in seat. It's a 6 to 9 month journey. And all of a sudden you work with a small freelancers, you need something done within 3 days, someone starts working on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people tell you, well, you know, but it's not the same quality, but it's not exactly the same person. Fine. I'm not going to argue that. I can tell you one thing after, again, 20 plus years in the industry, 70% of something is a hell of a lot more than 100% of nothing. So get going, start executing. And if you want a full-time person, keep hiring that full-time person, but start executing tomorrow with what you can. And so moving forward, sorry to your question, I'm kind of blabbing here.
No, it's all good. It's interesting.
You know, the company ended up going anywhere, but I really liked the model of working with freelancers. Mm-hmm. So my next job, I worked at a company called Kenshu. I ran product, go to market there. And I try to import that model of working with freelancers into the company, and it was impossible. And it was impossible because in that journey, I started realizing that if I, as a manager or an executive in the company, wants to start working with freelancers, like, where do I find them? How do I onboard? Do they just swipe a credit card and start working with freelancers? The company doesn't want it that way. Have they signed an NDA? There's all these things that start coming into play that are very, very different than, you know, hey, I'm an individual who just wants to get something done.
Right.
And so I started exploring this space, and then I started seeing signals. IRS is forecasting 60% of workforce being freelance. IRS, the American IRS, sorry. Mm-hmm. Forecasting 60% of workforce, US workforce, will be freelancing by 2030. That back then was 11 years out. Wasn't that far. And COVID has accelerated everything, but that was about 10 years out.
Interesting.
By 2025, 50% of workforce will be freelancers. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we start seeing these numbers coming in, and I kind of came to this analysis around end of 2018, early 2019, that we're kind of in the midst of a perfect storm to workforce transformation. Mm-hmm. On the one end, you have companies and agencies to that matter that need to move faster. Pace of change is just insane. And to take your average agency today, new marketing channels, new communication channels, you know, you got to spin up content very fast. You got to be everything needs to happen from the moment you need it until you need to get it out very quickly. So 2 years ago, agencies didn't know what TikTok is. Now they have to be, again, depends on what it is you're promoting. You don't have that experience. Now, so the velocity of change is just requires flexibility for corporate. Number two, from a monetary perspective and financial perspective, the flexibility of an organization will determine their ability to survive. I mean, we live in the past 2 decades, we had 3 catastrophic economic crises, 2000, 2008, 2020 with COVID, where organizations needed to quickly scale down and very quickly scale back up and scale down and scale back up and scale down.
It's just, yeah.
That is leading organizations to realizing they completely need to adapt to how they're working. That's on the corporate side or the agency side. On the talent side, we're seeing a generational shift. New generation, young millennials, Gen Z, don't want to have full-time employment. Mm-hmm. By the way, in agencies, I think it was always the case. But even in corporates, millennials, Gen Z, don't want to be employed the way we were employed or my generation was employed. They're not looking for a single employer. They don't want a gold watch when they go to retirement. I remember when I got into the industry, it was you don't stay at the same company for more than 7 or 8 years. Now, when I, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you don't stay more than 4 years in the same company. Now the average is 1.9 years within the same company. So
yes,
they don't want to be employed. They're moving fast. In a survey ran in 2018 across high schools in the United States, 45% of Gen Z students say they will never take a steady job. 45%. That's insane.
Wow.
Some of them will regret it and will find their way eventually to steady jobs because they realize that not having a steady job means you always have to be working and getting your next job, if you will. So generational shift is one. Number two, cloud computing and internet really changed how we work. So connectivity, digital nomads, remote work. Again, it's not just COVID. Even before COVID, 2017, 2018, there were 2,800 companies, 2,800 companies in 2018 that didn't have offices in the US, all remote work. And now obviously with COVID, that has accelerated it. Mobility and you know, digital nomads has made it easier. And so working with anyone anywhere is simpler than ever. So if you tie all these things together, we're kind of in the new wave of a revolution. That's the workforce revolution, where you'll be able to very quickly stitch together teams to execute against whatever it is you're trying to execute. You'll have full-time employees that are core, and around them you'll build more and more flexible talent according to the needs that you have. Some of them will be there for a day a week. Some of them will be there for a specific project. Some of them will be there for 3 months. Doesn't matter. But that will become, over the next 5 years, the most important muscle that organization, agencies more than anyone else will have. You'll have a pool of resources, if you're good at creating, that you can tap into when you need. And content writer and graphic designer and PPC and execute whatever it is. And you'll construct those teams to execute, and then you'll move on to the next project and rebuild a new team.
Interesting. Yeah, that's so fascinating. And yeah, I think it's something that is definitely so beneficial to agencies to be working with freelancers. What is the main benefit of working with freelancers as opposed to having, you know, an in-house team?
It's a great question. First of all, it depends on what you're trying to do, right? It's not always better to work with freelancers compared to full-time employees. I think you need to examine it like a lot of different things, right?
Yes.
It's very similar. When should you open a remote office? Well, it depends what it is you're trying to do in that location. I'll tell you this. What we're seeing in the last 10 years, or probably two decades, we're seeing an era where skills are becoming more of micro skills. You know, I remember 2005, we started seeing, you know, ads for online marketeer, right? Remember that? There were people search for an online marketing manager, something like that, right? Online marketing has become now 20 different things.
It's massive.
You have social, and within social, you got Facebook, you got Pinterest, you got TikTok, you got Instagram, you got Snapchat. It's like, okay, is there someone that knows all of it and can manage A, even if there's someone that knows, there's no way to manage all of it. And so if you're getting into these micro skills, right? We used to have, again, 2-3 decades ago, copywriter, right? In agencies that produce TV ads, radio ads, copywriters. Now there's micro copy, there's long form copy, there's blog. It's like everything is becoming more and more of a micro skill. Now your average organization cannot have full-time employees for each of these skills. Because A, you don't have enough work for all of that. It's too expensive. Mm-hmm. And then you got to start right-sizing it to whatever it is you need to execute. And so let's take, you know, again, and agencies are a great example because they work on projects. And so you're one of the agencies that you're working with or that are listening in need to write, you know, have just won a campaign for, I don't know, Nike, let's go. And, you know, Nike wants them to run their Super Bowl ad, right? What do you need for a Super Bowl ad? You need an art director. You need a scriptwriter. You need actors. You need copywriters. It's like you need all these things.
Yes.
Guess what? Most likely you don't have them in-house. And if you have them in-house, they probably don't step up to the level that Nike needs. And so all of a sudden it's like, okay, so open your head and start building that team. Now, what we're saying is either companies are saying, okay, I need it now, but then that muscle hasn't been trained. It's like you don't decide one morning you want to run a marathon. And you don't decide one morning you can produce a Nike ad. You got to build over time this pool of talent that on demand you can pull them in to execute on a project. Mm-hmm. I can tell you my personal experience, and I told you about when I moved on to Kenshu. At some point, the CEO asked me to take over marketing. And I think we had a team of, 10 or 12 people in marketing.
Okay.
They were all okay. No one was super strong at anything specific. They were mostly generalists. Some better at this, some better at that. No one was great. There were so many territories that weren't conquered.
Okay.
My first week on the job, I laid off 4 or 5 people. As I made the decision that with a mediocre team, I can't get very far. Mm-hmm. I laid off 4 or 5 people. They weren't bad. They were just generalists and I needed experts. Right. And I think it was mid-year, so I had like $700,000 become available. This is 2017, 18. And I deployed all that into freelancers. And you know, I brought in all of a sudden, you know, an SEO expert for a day a week. I didn't need more than a day a week, an SEO expert and someone to rebuild our SEM campaigns and 2 external content writer and someone to rewrite our emails. Someone to clean up our Salesforce. I got 12 different freelancers to help augment what I had in-house with their expertise. Mm-hmm. And within 3 months, we tripled all of previous year's leads. And it's not because I'm some marketing expert, but we have, you know, our brains are limited by what we think we can execute given what we have. But if you start thinking, you know, what if I'm not limited by this talent pool? What if I can pull in now, you know, a great content writer? What if I'm not trying to have my team produce a blog a week or, you know, 2 blogs a month? I'm going to put some of my dollars on getting someone to produce 4 blogs a week. So it opens up new possibilities. Again, it's not everyone has the same challenges and need the same talent, obviously, but just it opens up a world of opportunities.
Interesting. And then, so what would be, or are there any risks associated with working with freelancers?
First and foremost, I think the biggest barrier to working with freelancers that we're seeing are mostly mindset. Most organizations or people within are approaching this saying, it's not going to work. When you're going that way, mostly it's not going to work. because you're not giving it an honest chance. Yeah. Second, people have a tendency of saying, you know, when I'll need it, I'll go find someone. And guess what? When you need it, it's too late. Because if you have an emergency, hey, I need to produce this Nike ad in 2 weeks from now, and I don't have the freelance talent pool, and I don't have the freelancers that I trust, then most likely they're not available next week. And if they are available, it's like you don't have that relationship. You never worked with them. So it's going to be difficult to create. So you need to understand there's a journey in building this flexible workforce. The next thing I would say is you got to realize that there's a difference between hiring a freelancer for, you know, a 48-hour gig, working with them for 2 weeks, or getting someone to do 6 months with you. So that it doesn't require the same level of validation interviews. It's like, just find that right level of adjusting the process to what it is you're trying to execute. The other side I will say has to do with area that most of us don't like to deal with, and that's, you know, bureaucracy, compliance, policies. Dealing with freelancers has regulations in almost every country. It's like you got to make sure that you're paying legal entities, as an example. So if I want to pay, you know, I want to work with Julia as a freelancer, it is my responsibility as the business to validate that Julia doesn't belong to a terror organization, drug cartel. Her bank account is clean. She's not on any blacklist. In today's world, she's not in Russia. It's like all these things have to come into play, because otherwise you're violating the law working with that individual. So that's the first thing you need to do. So as an example, it's a barrier, because if I'm a small company or an agency, I don't have the effort figuring out whether Julia is legal or not. I just want to make sure that whatever it is I'm working with, Julia is legal. That's number one. Number two, you have to make sure that, you know, the data remains yours, confidentiality remains yours. So NDAs are signed, IP, you own IP. We've seen more than a dozen cases, at least, of companies hiring freelancers, giving them work, not making sure they're signing legal document. And then 2-3 years down the road, they're going for a funding round. And then these freelancers pop up and say, hey, you know, I own IP in that company. And that's because no one made them sign over IP when they conducted the deal. And so these little nuances, I know a specific company that ended up paying, they got acquired by Apple. They ended up paying $250,000 for a graphic designer, because when Apple did the due diligence, they realized they don't own IP for whatever piece of graphic he made. And that cost them like $250,000 just to clean up.
Oh, wow.
And so you want to make sure that IP is cleansed. You got to make sure tax forms are filled correctly if you're an American agency, or you got to fill in W-8s, W-9s, you got to submit 1099s at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. IRS in the United States is becoming more and more prudent about it. If you're not submitting tax forms, you're up to $3 million in fines, yearly fines. No one wants to be there, obviously.
Yep.
And last but not least, you're exposed to something called workforce classification. You don't want to be in a situation where either the state or the freelancers will come and claim, based on the relationship you have with this person, they were actually your employee and not a contractor. Now you owe them Social Security, you owe the state some taxes and all this. And so all these things together are some things you have to be wary of. Most of them are things that, again, part of what Stoke is doing is streamlining the entire process and kind of providing the governance and the assurance that you're avoiding all of these. But if you're doing it manually, these are things you have to be wary of.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. So you guys are going to help, you know, if agencies are using your tool, to just do like the background checks on the freelancers that they're hiring, and you guys would facilitate the NDAs and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so Stoke is really providing kind of a full lifecycle management for the freelancers. So it's onboarding, making sure they sign the legal documents, running the KYC or AML on them to make sure they're legal, getting them to sign the right legal documents, refreshing the legal documents on a given period, every 3 months, 6 months, whatever period you want, handling payouts to freelancers in 190 countries, 80 different currencies, but also handling everything from, you know, managing them on the execution basis, making sure they get paid, controlling budget, keeping the agency's margins on each project, just providing, you know, a platform to manage the entire life cycle.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah, we're going to be wrapping up here shortly. So we're definitely going to get you to, you know, share with us where our listeners can get in touch with you to learn more about Stoke. But first, I really want to learn about your experience with getting acquired by Fiverr. So can you share with our listeners a little bit about what that journey was like?
Yeah, sure. You know, Stoke was founded in end of Q1, early Q2 of 2019. That's when we raised our seed round. We're about to launch the marketing Q1 of 2020. And then COVID hit, and then we kind of said, okay, let's see what's going on. If it's really Armageddon or it's going to fly by. We ended up launching in July of that year when we saw that, you know, the market's, it's behaving pretty well. Mm-hmm. And then we had our A round, I think 6 or 9 months later from Battery Ventures, we raised 15 million. And we're doing pretty well. You know, the Fiverr acquisition wasn't something I was expecting. We, you know, we still had, I think, most of the money, 13 million in the bank. We could have run for another 2 years.
Yeah.
I knew the Fiverr team for a while. So when we started the company, someone introduced me to Ofer, their CFO. And, you know, I consulted him multiple times during our journey. You know, how to work with freelancers, how to handle payments, how to handle international taxations, like things that... there were kind of correlated between both our businesses. Obviously, Fiverr, public, you know, multi-billion-dollar company, and we're a small startup.
Yeah.
But that was the basis for our relationship. And he got exposed to what we're doing, and, you know, we chatted where the industry is heading. And so we had a good foundation mm-hmm. for our relationship. And when we did our A round, I consulted him, and actually Fiverr wanted to participate in the round and put some money into Stoke.
Interesting.
And we ended up not having enough room for them to put something that would be meaningful enough for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, parted way friendly, obviously. And, you know, I think it was 2 months later, 3 months later, he called me up one day and kind of said, you know, after going through your pitch deck and the strategy, you know, we looked a bit deeper into what you guys are doing. We looked deeper into the market and kind of understood where you're heading and creating this category. And, you know, as Fiverr has a strategy of going up market, you guys are coming, you know, more to companies rather than small, medium businesses. We think there's enough, we're completing each other pretty well. What do you think about us buying you? It was very, you know, very Israeli, very blunt.
Yeah.
and you know, I was being Israeli myself, I was blunt. And I told him, you know, I have enough money in the bank. I don't have plans to get bought out. However, you know, my first commitment is to the board, the investors, the employees, and I need to treat this as a business. And so, you know, let's have a conversation, not about the numbers, but what would it mean? What would the day after look like? What would the integrated platform would look like? What can we do together? And we spent, you know, a few hours together, you know, a few beers, lunches, spent time with Micha, the CEO. And once we got aligned into, you know, enough, because you never really know what the day after an acquisition looks like.
Yeah.
But you get to a point where you can say, I think it's okay. I think it's going to be okay. Right.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Now that we got that through, it's like, we're either going to get the numbers to work or not. And if the numbers work out, it made total sense. And from that point, it was easy. Relatively easy, right? It was extremely stressful few weeks, but it was easy.
How long was the process from when they sort of first came to you with the idea to it being, to you guys being acquired?
You know, in the process, it feels very long. I'll tell you now, end to end, I think it was under 60 days.
Wow, that's incredible.
From initial call to closing, it was, you know, sorry, almost 80 days. It was 2.5 months. But we had local holidays in the midst. We slowed things down, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has your day-to-day changed after that acquisition? How has your life kind of changed?
Well, you know, it has changed. First of all, one of the things we've done in the process, kind of agreed on the fact that Stoke stays as a standalone business company. We cannot be touched for the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so we keep running as a standalone business, and my organization is staying intact. All employees are there. We're growing like a startup. The money from the investment is still mine to use. And so from that aspect, we run that way. But once we were in the door, you know, I saw so many potential intersection points between what Fiverr does, what we do, that we started digging into, you know, what potentially can we do together? How quickly can we do that? And from that point on, you know, you're dealing with larger organization, which, you know, where I spent most of my career. You're when you're a 30 people startup, it's like all the decisions, all the cycles are very short. So when you get into a, you know, 1200 people organization, all of a sudden there's more opinions, there's more processes, takes time to digest. I gotta tune my pace again to that pace.
Yeah.
It's not a good or a bad, it's the dynamics. But yeah, I think I'm currently spending probably 70% of my time Stoke, 30% of my time Stoke Fiverr.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. That's a really, really cool story. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Sure. Gladly.
Yeah. So if any agency owners who are listening are interested in, you know, testing out Stoke and just learning a little bit more about the platform, what is the best way for them to go about doing that?
The easiest way, you can go on our website, stoketalent.com, and, you know, sign up for a demo. But also, you know, if you're listeners, you can feel free to reach out directly to me. Happy to give you the royal treatment. You can find me on LinkedIn, or you can email me directly. It's Shahar, S-H-A-A-J-R @stoketalent.com. And I promise I'll give you all the attention you need.
Amazing. Well, we are going to now move on to the fast five, which are five rapid fire questions.
Ooh.
So what's a book you've read that's made an impact on you?
First of all, I'm a reader. So I try to read a lot, but I haven't read enough in the last 2 years. I just actually finished a book last week or 2 weeks ago. It's called The Mockingbird. It's about France during World War II, during when the Nazis took over France. It's about two sisters and how they behave. It's a very interesting perspective, you know, being Jewish, and my grandparents were, you know, in the camps and everything. So I have a very strong point of view, obviously, about what happened during the war. But there are sides to that war that I never thought about or read about. But it feels like being a normal civilian in an occupied country, and how people survived, what they had to do to survive, just as normal, even if they weren't in the camps, if they didn't lose their families, just the impact it had. So yeah. Highly recommended.
Interesting. So it's called The Mockingbird?
Yep.
Okay, very good. And what does your morning routine look like?
Usually I start my days early, usually I start my days early, 5:30 to 6 a.m. and go for a morning workout. At some point during, you know, the phases of a startup, when I was the single sales rep and I took all long night calls, I failed that routine. I'm getting back to it over the past few months, where now I have a 5-people sales team, so I don't have to take all sales calls anymore.
Amazing. And is there a CEO that you follow or study?
When I was younger, I read all of Jack Welch's books. Jack Welch, I think, is too old for the audience already these days. He passed away last year. But Jack Welch was kind of the legendary CEO at General Electric. He was their CEO for about 21 years. He wrote his first book, I think, is called Jack Straight from the Gut. He tells amazing stories about his early career and his evolution within GE. And then there's another book he wrote. Phenomenal stories. I mean, again, I don't know if people will relate to those still today. I remember reading those 10 or 15 years ago, and that really influenced me. I met him once in a restaurant in 2003.
Oh, no way.
He was already pretty old back then, yeah. It was accidental, though, in Boston. So Jack's one. Ben Horowitz. I was fortunate to work at HP when HP acquired Opsware, and Ben Horowitz was their CEO. And HP had a policy back then. HP did not have offices. It was all open space. And Ben was sitting across the hall from me. Okay. That was before Ben became Andreessen Horowitz. It was just Ben Horowitz. And it's a very nice person till this day. I think his His book, The Hard Thing About the Hard Things, is a tremendous book to understand management styles and how to cope with, you know, challenging times and how to be creative. You know, from the top of my head, I would say these two.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely going to check out Jack Welch. That sounds like a really interesting person to follow. And what is your favorite online tool?
Wow. What is my favorite online tool? I guess Slack. I use the most now. I don't know if it's my favorite. I just use the most.
Yeah, it's the most helpful.
Yeah, it's you know, just communicate through it constantly.
Okay. And then, so last question, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
You know, it's funny, but I would say that relationships are more important than execution, I think.
Interesting.
You know, I started my career really constantly just focusing on getting things done right, getting things done fast. And, you know, I couldn't care stepping on other people's toes, you know, battling people over, you know, who's the smartest person in the room and things like that. And I think in the later stage in my career, when someone put a mirror in front of me, I think it was 2011, and I started being in more senior manager roles and I saw the people around, it's like, yeah, it's a lot easier to get things done when you have friends and not enemies.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's all about who you know, in the grand scheme of things, you never know when an opportunity will present itself. So yeah, always got to be building those connections.
Exactly that.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Shahar. It was a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I really enjoyed learning about your story.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Julia. It was great to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Agency Toolkit. We hope you've learned something new that you can implement into your agency today. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.